Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan Natives.
Welcome to Chinook Profiles. I'm Paula Schiller. Billy Mills was the first American to win the Olympic 10,000-meter run, and he was the first Native American to do it. His 1964 gold medal in Tokyo was a surprise victory. Few people believed in him, and that's the basis of his keynote address to the AFN convention last fall. He said that people need people to believe in them. To illustrate, he described what happened before the start of his historic race.
I'm sitting on my bed, 2 hours before the race, rooming with little old Jerry Lindgren. Jerry's coach came into the room. We need people to believe in us, for example. And Jerry's coach said, Jerry, here's a list of the top 10 distance runners in the world. The men you have to beat to win the gold medal. You've all experienced this. I want to review the names with you. The coach started out, number one, number five, number seven. And I'm thinking, my name, the top 10 in the world, my name has to be on that list. Right? Number eight. And by then I'm praying. Number 10, and I'm nowhere on the darn list. My little world begins to fall apart. And the coach said, Jerry, is there anybody we might have overlooked? You've been there, right? Jerry got out of bed standing there with nothing but his shorts on, the furthest looking thing from an athlete. He said, you know, coach, I've been training with Billy Mills. I think Bill has a chance to win. Somebody believing in me. The confidence went back up. I get dressed and I go to the training room for a rubdown. You've experienced this. As I entered the training room, here's the assistant track and field coach. Here's the trainer. They don't see me come into the room, but I'm close enough to hear their conversation, which was, you know, it's a shame. It's a shame Lindgren sprained his ankle. Because if little old Jerry's ankle doesn't hold up, do you realize all we have left is Billy Mills. My response was, to hell with them. I grew up in that kind of a world where nobody believed in me. It's time to go to the track. It's time to get ready for the race. And as I'm going out of the village, there's a long distance phone call. They're paging me. I'm in Tokyo, Japan, thousands of miles away. I picked up the phone. It's my sister in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, on the Ogallala Sioux Reservation. She started out, Bill, I hope we're not bothering you. We know you can be in about 7 or 8 hours. She was unaware of the drastic time change. Thank God we've been able to reach you. Listen, we love you. Regardless of what happens, and we're disconnected. I didn't have time to put the call back through, but the simple thought, somebody back home's thinking about me. Somebody cares. The confidence went back up. And I rush out and I get on the bus. Here's the aisle of the bus. And there are two vacant seats. And I'm no different than the young men here or the old men. Here's a vacant seat over here by Randy Matson, a 285-pound shot putter. Off over here is a vacant seat by a very beautiful woman from Poland. Obviously. Obviously, I ignored Randy Matson. And I sat by the young lady from Poland. And in the beginning, it was a mistake. She spoke English. She saw my track shoes in my hand. And she said, ah, tell me, who do you think's going to win? I couldn't respond. She tapped me on the elbow. She said, who do you think's going to win? Ron Clark, the world record holder from Australia, or maybe, Peter Blitnikoff, the defending champion from Russia. Now she's given me a choice. But isn't that the choice we have received most of our lives? A choice that does not include us. But one of the exciting things about our lives, whether or not we're included, we can include ourselves. All we do is step forward. And we include ourselves. Digging down as deep as I could, for the first time in my life, I came up with, very quietly, what I came up with. I'm gonna win. And there's complete silence. We go to the track. We go through our warm-up. 50 seconds before the race. There's complete silence. We're lined up on the track. I'm in the second row, 9 people out. Was in the Marine Corps at the time. A friend of mine is in the Marine Corps with me. Competed the day before and lost out. Went out that night, let the good times roll. How he made it back to the stadium, I don't know, but he showed up. He's leaning over the rail. 50 seconds before the race was to start, he breaks the silence. He breaks the silence with his words, "Hey, Bill, look up, look up." I had nothing better to do, so I looked up. His words were, "I had this weird dream last night. I dreamt you won the 10,000 meter run. Somebody believing in me." The confidence went back up. And you've all experienced this next circumstance. Now it's 5 seconds before the race starts. Once again, there's complete silence. And once again, the silence is broken by my friend. This time, as he began to laugh. And I realized how much he believed in his own dream. But then the gun went off, the race got underway, and for the next 3 laps, all I could hear was the ringing of my friend's laughter in my ears. And he came so close to reaching out and to stealing the dream I had for 15 years. And yet how often do we allow people to reach out and take away one of our dreams? Or how often do we take away a dream of someone else? And that dream is going to be taken away unless we have a basic philosophy of who we are and where we're going and how we're going to get there. And it finally dawned on me that my friend didn't even have a chance to sleep last night, let alone dream. So I forgot about it. Lap after lap after lap, runners fall behind. We crossed the 3 mile in 13 minutes and 28 seconds. And we had more than 3 more miles to go. I was in fourth place, and you've experienced this. There was no way I could continue. I was gonna quit. But rather than quitting while I was in fourth, I decided to take the lead, go one more lap, then quit. It's easier that way. It's easy to quit when you think you're winning, right? I took the lead, I went one more lap, and when you quit a distance race, you glance into the infield because you want to quit when nobody recognizes you. Because that's also easier. I glanced into the infield. All of the officials were Japanese. We're in Tokyo, Japan. Nobody knew me. Anywhere was a good place to quit. And I'm thankful to this day, you also checked out the stands. I glanced into the stadium. 90,000 people in the stadium. And who do I focus in on? My wife. She was the only person there who was aware of me. What made me hurt? What my goals were? I'm thinking about quitting, and I know these were my wife's thoughts. And there's no way I could quit. There's no way you can quit. You continue. Just lap after lap after lap. 375 yards to go. And I quit. I'm no different than anybody here. I quit. But deep down inside, it's like an electrical shock going through your body, something telling me, Bill, if you try harder than you've ever tried before in your life. Not that you're gonna win. That's too simple. But that there's hope. There's a chance. And you begin to drive. You're beginning to pump with the arms. You're lifting the knees. You begin to lose your vision. All you're aware of is the throbbing of your heart and your own thoughts. 300 yards to go, 25 yards behind. The thoughts beginning to change from one more try, so clearly today, over and over again, to I can win, I can win, I can win, I can win. 110 yards to go, 12 yards behind, 90 yards, 80 yards to go. You see the tape stretched across the finish line. 60 yards to go, my thoughts changing from I can win, so clearly today, to I won, I won, I won, I won. And then you feel the tape breaking across your chest, in your own little trance, in your own little world, and you've experienced it in other ways. My thoughts over and over again, I won, I won, I won. What brought me back to reality was the Japanese official that came running up to me. And as he grabbed me, he put his hands on my shoulders to take me to the press conference and the victory ceremony. His words were, "Who are you?" That's what people are asking us today. They're asking you people as ladies of Omaha, the Lasher, who are you? They're asking us as Ogallala Sioux tribal members in South Dakota, who are you? And we have not only the opportunity, but the responsibility to take that simple step forward and to tell them who we are. And it's a tremendous feeling and a tranquil peace of mind to be able to look at somebody in the eyes and to tell them who you are. And so you don't misunderstand me. I ran track for 15 years, for 45,000 miles, not to become what I accomplished, a little gold medal winner at the Olympic Games. But in retrospect, I did what I did to have a better understanding of who I am as an individual, as an athlete, as an Ogallala Sioux, as a human being. And I'm convinced beyond a doubt that we control the destiny, not only of Alaska, but we control the destiny of the United States because of the talent within this room, the human talent throughout Indian country, and because of our natural resources. And we need to begin by developing that basic concept of unity, the basic aspects of a group and a personal philosophy, and we need to pursue it. And the climax of my experiences was going back to the Olympic Village. And as I walked in, they're painting me. I picked up the phone. It's my sister back in Pine Ridge. Her words, "Bill, I hope I'm not bothering you. Sorry we were disconnected. We understand you compete in about 2 hours. Thank God we've been able to reach you." And I broke in with, "Guess what? Guess what? I won the gold medal. I set the Olympic record." There's complete silence. She came back with, "Bill, please, please don't tease us that way. Don't tease us that way, it's too cruel. We don't even believe one another within a family, let alone corporations." And I repeated, I won the gold medal. She started crying. She woke everybody else up in the house. They were all crying. Except my 8-year-old nephew, 8 years of age. He came to the phone, and his words were, "Uncle Bill, I knew all along you were going to win." And I started crying. I felt after 15 years and 45,000 miles, I deserved it. And I said, "Downey, tell me, how did you know? How did you know that I was going to win? In total innocence." And this is what I'll leave you with. In total innocence, his words were, "Uncle Bill, I knew all along you were going to win. Maybe not win that race, but I knew you were going to win something because I've been asking God to let you."
Olympic gold medal winner and Ogallala Sioux Billy Mills, the keynote speaker at the AFN convention last fall. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
This is Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. The Alaska Federation of Natives Convention is a time to get together to discuss all aspects of Native affairs, and quite often that includes state and national matters, especially in the area of D2 legislation. After the keynote speech at last fall's convention, there was a panel on D2. First off, AFN President Morris Thompson explained the lobbying effort in Washington on behalf of Alaska Natives.
One of the philosophies that we've taken consistently over the years in the D2 issue is one that AFN and the regional corporations does not endorse any particular piece of legislation, whether we don't align ourselves, in other words, with the environmentalists, we don't align ourselves with the developers, we don't align ourselves with the sports groups, we don't align ourselves with the timber interests, but that we have four basic things that we have lobbied for consistently in the legislative approach. And let me tell you why I think that's a sound policy. It's fair to say that we've been wooed by all sides to try to align with one side or the other. We are pleased in that one regard that people view the Native lobby as probably one of the most effective lobbies in Washington, D.C. from the state. And I say that with all candor and with all sincerity. But we did feel that it was in the long-term best interest of the Native community to be aligned with any particular group, because while we do have a good sense for the political scene in Washington, we honestly don't have that much wisdom as to determine which bill is going to pass. So rather than align ourselves, we've indicated our areas of interest, I mentioned this morning, broadly for technical amendments to the Act, the land swamps, submerged lands, and subsistence. And we've been subsequently successful in having those basic tenets or the basic amendments included in both major bills that have gone through Congress. In other words, we're on the environmental list of considerations. We were in the Bro Huckabee aspects of the bill when it passed Congress. So we think that we've positioned the Native community fairly well without having anyone saying that we are favoring this one element of the state's constituency over the other. So it's been a very balanced approach, not very well understood, I might add, for members of the press, not very well understood in the state, but we think it's a balanced, reasoned approach to D2 legislation.
Some of the D2 amendments sought by AFN and the regional corporations are in the House bill. Some are in the Senate version. There are over 70 amendments which deal directly with Native issues, and most have been agreed to in principle in both bills. John Shively of the Nana Corporation has spent a great deal of time in Washington working on the bills, and he presented one of the clearest summaries heard so far of the most crucial amendments.
I think one of the primary concerns that a lot of Natives have had about the Claims Act is what people call the 1992 issues. What happens in 1992 when our tax exemption is over for undeveloped land? What happens in 1992 when our stock can be sold? So AFN spent some time addressing those issues, and we have three amendments that deal with them. The first amendment, and the most simple, is that we have an extension of the tax moratorium on undeveloped land. So rather than the tax moratorium running as it does now, from 20 years from 1971 when the Act passed, it will run 20 years from the date you actually received your land. So that's, I think, a big and positive change. The second thing we've done that relates to that, we've developed, in conjunction with the state and the Department of Interior, a land bank. This land bank will allow native corporations to take land that they don't want to develop and come to agreements with the state and federal government as to how those lands and adjacent federal and state lands will be managed. If such an agreement can be reached, the native lands then go into a land bank where they cannot be taxed as long as they're in that land bank. The initial term is
5 years.
5 years.
No, initial term is 10 years and 5 year renewals.
The initial term is 10 years, and then you get 5 year renewals. So if you get your land in the land bank, it cannot be taxed. It can also not be taken from you if your corporation gets into trouble in business and goes bankrupt, which, as we know, might be a potential down the line. The land bank is fairly complex. I think there may be questions on it later, and Don is much more qualified to handle those than I am. But anyway, we consider that to be really essential to protecting the land and offers us a great deal more protection than we had in the original settlement. The third issue is what happens to stock in 1992. You know, after, as the law states now, the corporations will issue new stock in 1992. That stock can be sold, it can be pledged for loans, it can be taken for debts, almost anything can happen to it. There was a lot of disagreement on how to approach this problem, if indeed it was even a problem. But I think most native corporations see it a problem for two reasons. One, in 1992, it may still be unclear on how valuable native stock is, and people may be tempted to sell their native stock for way too little, much as many people have gone out and sold limited entry permits for way under what they're worth now. Same kind of problem, because people 2, 3, 5 years ago didn't know what those limited entry permits were going to be worth. Well, in 1992, I'm relatively convinced most people won't know how valuable native stock is. So that's one problem. The second problem is, if native corporations are successful, and if they have valuable resources, like oil and minerals, which many of us do, then other corporations may want to own the native corporations. They may come in and try to buy the stock from people so they can control it. Well, so we consider those two problems. What we've done is we've come up with the Congress authorizing native corporations to allow the shareholders to vote to make certain changes in your articles of incorporation to provide some protection. There are two kinds of protection. The first protection would be that the native corporation, and if you agree, the family would have the right of first refusal on the stock. So in other words, if somebody came up to me, said, or I came up to somebody and said, I'd like to buy your stock. He said, sure, that's okay. I said, I'll offer you $1,000. He said, that's fine. Well, first they'd have to go to the native corporation and perhaps the person's immediate family, and they would get the right to buy the stock first before I did. That's one protection. That mostly is protection for the shareholder, because during that period when the shareholder has to go back and get approval or give the regional corporation or the village corporation a chance to buy that stock, somebody can tell them, $1,000, that's nonsense. That stock's worth $10,000 or $12,000 or whatever. You know, you're being robbed. So it's a real protection, we think, for the shareholder. It prevents stock being sold in bars, taken by used car dealers, or any number of other things. Second thing that you've made your bylaws to do is to provide that only natives or their direct descendants can vote the stock. So in other words, if I come in and buy the stock, or if Exxon comes in and buys the stock, or somebody else to try to control their native corporation, I can't vote it. Exxon can't vote it. They can get a dividend, just like any other stockholder, but they can't control the corporation by voting. Again, this is something that is optional. If the amendment passes, each corporation is going to have to amend their bylaws with at least 50% of the shareholders agreeing to it. We think, given all things, it's the best we can do at this point. Anyway, those are the three 1992 issues. The other issues I will just touch on briefly, or some of them anyway. There are some amendments that relate to money. We've got, assuming the bill passed, there will be a special appropriation for native groups. As those of you who are in groups know, there's no money for groups in the bill. We have a way to value land for tax purposes that was not in the bill. We have an amendment that provides us an appropriation of about $1 million worth of interest that the government tried to take or has taken back from us. And also to speed up one set of payments, the Alaska Native Fund from the federal government, means we get our money a little earlier. There are also a number of amendments that relate to land conveyance. Some of the more important ones are, the first one was very important 2.5 years ago when we started work on it, and that was to get some expedited conveyance, to get lands conveyed faster to native corporations. That's less of a problem now that BLM is reorganized. I think land is being conveyed much quicker. As a matter of fact, I think there's some corporations who made the fields being conveyed too quickly these days. We're just as soon have the government sit on it a little longer while they get prepared to manage it. But anyway, there is a provision in the Act that would allow the option for village and regional corporations to get a speeded up land front, or land conveyance. There's a definition of the term interim conveyance. When your corporations get your land, most of you don't get patents, because patent can only take place after survey. You get interim conveyance. There are a lot of things in the Act that are triggered off of interim conveyance, like conveying village lands, some of the timber provisions. And nowhere in the Land Claims Act is interim conveyance defined, because this is a term that was made up by the Department of Interior with the help of some of us at AFN and some attorneys. So what we do is have Congress define interim conveyance, which will solve a lot of lawsuits down the line, I think, is the main purpose of it. One of the provisions of the Act that is always the most onerous to me is the fact that each village corporation has to give at least 1,280 acres to every to their municipal government or the state of trust. Now, 1,280 acres is way too much in my mind for most places. Downtown Anchorage, the old city of Anchorage, used to be about 1,280 acres. And since you consider that the village corporations already have to give people the homes where they live on, where people have businesses and things like that, we've always felt that that was a little high. So what we've got is an amendment that allows the village and the native, the village corporation and the municipal government and the state to negotiate what that figure should be. One of the most technical amendments, which I'm not going to try to explain here because I don't think confuse myself as well as the rest of you here, is something we call the Submerged Lands Amendment. But it's an amendment that deals with land that you get that's underwater. The problem essentially is that if land is underwater and the water's navigable, the state owns that land by the state constitution. But the only way you can figure out whether a body of water is navigable or not is to go all the way to court. And so what happens when you get your land is the Department of Interior says, well, we think that lake is navigable, but that lake isn't. So you don't get the land under this lake because it belongs to the state, but you do get the land under this one because we don't think it's navigable. Well, somebody could come along 10 years from now, 50 years from now, 200 years from now and say, well, the Department of Interior was wrong. That land is actually, our water is actually navigable. They go to court, they win, they take your land away from you. We have an amendment that allows a good deal of that land that's underwater to be deeded to the native corporation, but not charged. So in other words, if you lose this body, this land under this body of water 50 years from now, you don't lose anything in your entitlement. You lose some land, but you still got your 69,120 acres, whatever your entitlement is. It's about a 9-page amendment because we have spent a lot of time dealing with lawyers on it. But it's going to solve a lot of problems for us if we get it, because otherwise we're all going to be in court with the state trying to figure out what's navigable and what isn't.
That by no means covers all the amendments attached to the various D2 bills and to other acts before Congress, just some of the most important. And more than once it was stated that the failure to get any lands bill would be a major setback for the natives of Alaska. No bill, no amendments. From the D2 panel, you heard first AFN President Morris Thompson, followed by John Shively of the Nano Corporation. I'm Paula Schiller, and you've been listening to Chinook, a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.